Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. I am politically motivated by a concern with social justice, my colleague and guest today, Dr. Joaquin Villanueva, has written. As such, in my work, I am continually trying to answer the question, who has the right to the city? Dr. Villanueva is a member of the Geography Department at Gustavus, which he joined in 2013 and currently chairs. He earned his BA in Modern Languages, French and Italian, and Geography at the University of Puerto Rico, and his MA and PhD degrees in Geography at Syracuse University. In addition to teaching Introduction to Human Geography and Research Methods, he offers courses on urban and regional analysis, race and space in the U.S., urban geography, and geographies of peace and violence. He also advises students, presenting work at the Minnesota Undergraduate Geography Symposium, and is affiliated with the college's Latin American, Latinx, and Caribbean Studies program, or LALACS, and also the Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies program. He's also very active in his field, authoring peer-reviewed journal articles, book chapters, edited volumes, conference papers, presenting invited talks, and serving on the editorial boards of the scholarly journals Political Geography and AAG Review of Books. He's also president of the Puerto Rican Studies Association. The high quality of his scholarship is evident in two recent and highly competitive awards he received from the Antipode Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Professor Villanueva, moreover, is deeply committed to social justice, equity, and inclusion, both on and off campus. For his efforts, he received Gustavus's Mark H. Anderson Faculty Diversity Award for outstanding service and devotion to diversity. His work as a teacher scholar is important, timely, and interesting, and I'm delighted he could join me to talk about it, as well as his own story. So welcome, Joaquin. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time. I know you're busy. I always feel guilty when I'm on sabbatical here and interviewing colleagues who are working hard as we do when we're teaching. How's it going? Are you back in person now? How has it been for you during the pandemic?
Yeah, no, been teaching in person this academic year, and even though it's challenging, because I, we still have like these household duties with kids, on and off schools. It's still very rewarding to be back in the classroom and seeing students in person. And I think students also appreciate that as well.
Yeah. Are you, so were you all online or were you hybrid before coming back in person?
Yeah. So I was I mean, I lost track of time, as many of us have.
Prior
to this academic year, I was doing online virtual teaching, particularly because my kids were at home all the time as well. So that was needed to manage both, college students and school kids at the same time.
Right. How did that go for you all in all, both your kids and the Gustavus students?
It's not easy. Actually, we're back at that because, as you probably know, we have an ongoing teacher strike in Minneapolis School District. And so, which I am in solidarity with the demands of the teachers.
Me too.
Nevertheless, it creates a huge challenge to parents and guardians. I feel privileged that me and my partner can sort of stay at home for the most time and take care of them. But I understand that there's many families that don't have that privilege. So it's been challenging the last couple of years, to say the least.
Yeah, and I have to remember, I've spoken with colleagues who either don't have kids like Kate and myself, Kate Wittenstein and me, whose kids are older, and it's much less of a challenge, especially if you don't have kids like us teaching the Gustavus students online. But yeah, I can't imagine also then having to take care of your own kids who are also online. That's right. I think that strike started today. Is that right?
I think it was yesterday.
Yeah. Well, good luck with all that. You have two children or three? I can't remember.
Three.
Okay, you have your hands full. All right. Well, I was like you. I went back in person last fall. It felt good, even though we were wearing masks. And I'm looking forward to getting back. It's nothing like being in person. Tell us. I mean, I know you're from Puerto Rico, but beyond that, I don't know a whole lot about your background. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and you know, what it was like as a kid.
So I am originally from San Juan, Puerto Rico, and I was born and raised there. I was raised in the suburbs of San Juan and attended private Catholic school, which I often share with my students about my journey. And then after graduation there, I went to the University of Puerto Rico, and that's where I got, like, I think my political awakening, as the public institution, main public institution in Puerto Rico for higher education. The University of Puerto Rico, Rio Piedras campus, is a highly dynamic and politically active campus. I did my undergraduate degree, where I was able to learn a lot, not only inside the classroom, but outside the classroom, and get really a deeper understanding of the workings of empire and colonialism in Puerto Rico. As probably all of you know, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, and really you have a very strong political consciousness among students of understanding the various ways in which empire works. And the various critiques that students launch, and that really set me to a path to, when coming to grad school in the United States, I was able to take all that education with me to have a critical perspective when I came here.
That's interesting about your political awakening at the university. Were you involved in any kind of activism there, or organizations, movements?
I was not an official member of any organization, but I did. I was friends with many members of organizations, and activism was sort of part of the education. When I went to college in Puerto Rico, it was late 90s, early 2000s. So one of the biggest protests I ever attended was first when the Puerto Rican government and the people of Puerto Rico were protesting and demanding the exit of the U.S. Navy from the island municipality of Vieques.
Right, I remember.
That was a big one. So I remember joining the protest from the University of Puerto Rico and walking all the way to Old San Juan protesting that. Sure. And then a big one as well was the war in Iraq. I remember being engaged in many protests against the war, and then many others. You know, I could go on and on about the many protests that you participated there.
Yeah, I think I don't know about your parents. My it was during the Vietnam War when I was growing up, and that my father didn't go to college, but talked a lot about politics and what we call, I guess, current events at the dinner table, talked and argued. But my first real demonstration for sure was in college when it was an anti-war big march, and I happened to notice that a number of my history professors were at the head of it, which I kind of took pride in as a new. My memory is it was 1971. I was a first year, where we were sent a freshman student. It's interesting about campuses, both in this country and other countries, right? In France, you know that political awakenings of students. So were you back to the Catholic school for a second? Is that because you grew up Catholic? Your parents wanted you to go there? Or what was the story?
Yeah, it's like it's a Puerto Rico. I mean, it's changing now. It's probably a trend that's happening across Latin America and here as well, where Protestantism is taking over.
Right.
But Puerto Rico, as a former colony of Spain, it has a very strong Catholic tradition. And so my parents grew up Catholic. And so, yeah, that's like... that's where, you know, they sent me and my siblings to a Catholic school. It's very common. Private schools, you know, are a pretty common way of people getting an education as well.
Okay.
And so that's you know, part of a larger part of that colonial history, no? That I think
right,
that
exactly.
is part of Puerto Rico, no?
Right. What did your parents do? They weren't academics, or were they?
No, not at all. They attended college. So I'm not first gen, but they attended college. But they both work in a government office, an agency called which no longer exists. One of the victims of the current economic crisis. They work for the governmental bank of Puerto Rico, and so there was like a big agency that provided loans to businesses and other government instrumentalities. So my mom was a human resource employee, and my dad worked in the finance department. They both worked there. So as a kid, I used to go to their office and sort of be involved with like the bureaucracy of the government of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, given what you wind up doing, your work, were they, did they have would you say a political consciousness, or did they talk much about Puerto Rico vis-a-vis the U.S.?
Yes, although within the political spectrum of Puerto Rico, they were not like, so just in a nutshell, Puerto Rican politics are mainly structured around the status question, no?
Right.
So political parties are organized around that question mostly. And so you have a pro-independence party who has garnered very little support over the last few, a couple of decades, around 4 or 5%. Although last elections got like 11%, I believe. And then you have a pro-statehood party who has gathered a lot of support over the last, since the 1960s. And then you have a Commonwealth party who is a party who supports the current status of Puerto Rico, which is like this weird alliance with the United States where we're neither sovereign nor autonomous, but we're not a state either. So we're in between. And so that party has been very instrumental in the growth of modern Puerto Rico since the post-war era. Hmm. And so both my parents are affiliated with that party.
Okay. When you were in college and you were developing your own political consciousness, where were you on that spectrum, and where are you now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been out of Puerto Rico for far too long to affiliate with any political party there.
Yeah.
However, I when I was in college, I was firmly a supporter of the pro-independence party. That created a little bit of tension sometimes with my father, but not enough to, you know, sour the relationship.
That's good. Means.
But yeah, I was, they were very active in the political mobilization to kick out the U.S. Navy from Vieques. So I was really sort of involved at that time with protests and activism within the pro-independence party. But since then I have not sort of affiliated with them, although I do support the sovereignty of the people of Puerto Rico and the right to self-determination. That seems to be central to me. And
that's key. I would agree.
And, you know, I'm going on record saying that I do believe in a process of decolonization of Puerto Rico.
Right.
And the current status of a Commonwealth, of course, does not offer that. And statehood, I also firmly believe, does not lead to a process of decolonization.
Right. Yeah, so decolonization is the key for you now. Mm-hmm. By the way, were your parents affected by the hurricane? The most recent, how are they okay? Your family?
I mean, affected is a very broad term,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Yes, I do think like with Hurricane Maria, there was a collective traumatic process through the entire country. They did not lose any property, right?
Okay.
But for instance, like when the hurricane happened, my parents, I was living in St. Peter at the time, they came to stay with me for a whole month.
Wow.
Afterwards. And so we didn't have a big house at the time, so it got tense at times. So it was difficult times for everyone, and luckily they're fine, you know, but it did definitely had its toll, like both mentally and
right, physically the psychological. I just having gone through the tornado here, that hit me particularly hard mentally, mm-hmm. which I was completely unprepared for. So I can relate a bit. I'm glad they're okay, and I'm glad they're out of your house here now. that's a long time. No matter how much one loves one's parents, that's a long house or small house. Yeah, exactly. That's a long time. So what drew you, as you're in college, it looks, were you actually double majoring? Were you majoring in languages and geography? I'm just curious, when did you start becoming interested in geography, both as a kind of an idea and a discipline? Yeah, go ahead.
That's a good question. I started as a business major.
I love that. That's great.
And so, because I all I knew, as I told you, like was like my parents' job, you know.
Right.
And so when I only knew as a career the possibility of working in an office space, you know. So I said, I'm a business major. But upon going there, I clearly realized that I did not like it one bit. So I was yearning for something else. And I really wanted to travel. I really wanted to know the world. And I asked myself a question, what Aristotle will lead me to travel? You know, that was the key question. So I said, well, languages for once, you know, so right. I'm going to study French. And then second, geography sounds like a discipline that will allow me to travel. So that's how I ended up in both
disciplines. That's good. Oh, that's fantastic. I love that. And I'm sure you tell your students about having started out in business, which might surprise them. That's just great.
I was just telling them yesterday about that. We're just having this conversation and they were surprised.
I didn't know that. I'm surprised too. But I love that about how you chose. Yeah. So travel. What can I major in that would allow me to travel? Languages and geography. Perfectly good reason for those majors. Tell me a little bit about, you know, there's the phrase I have two questions really. Tell me a little bit about the discipline, what geography involves. Because I think, and also I'm interested in human geography. I don't know if that's a subfield of geography, but you know, so many people think of geography as just sort of the study of what land and maps, right? but it's so much more than that, as your own really quite fascinating work shows. But maybe help us understand what the discipline involves.
A great question. So geography as a discipline is a very broad and interdisciplinary field. And which is, if I can summarize, it's concerned with the spatial relationships, meaning with relationships that could be within natural processes, or it could be between humans and their environment, and between animals and so forth. But it's really thinking spatially. The way I put it, for instance, since I'm talking to a historian, you are used to thinking temporally, you know?
Right.
And so we do think temporally as well, but we do emphasize the spatial
is key.
The spatial relationships among events and peoples and processes. Within geography, because so interdisciplinary, we can do this from the natural sciences perspective. Then you have what we call a physical geography, which we offer at Gustavus, which tends to emphasize the physical process of the earth. You know?
Okay, that's maybe the more familiar to people, right?
Yeah, and so people study like rivers, mountains, different climates and so forth, no? And so then you have the human geography aspect, which is tends to focus more on humans' interactions with their environment, whether natural environment or social environment. And so that's a wide field as well, because within human geography, you have a great diversity of research interest and focus. So you can have, like me, that I'm interested in political and urban geography, so interested in processes at the city level. But you have other people that are interested in energy geography I'm also interested in racial relations and their manifestations in space. I mean, I can go on and on about how diverse geography is, and it's what I call a truly liberal arts discipline.
Yes. Yeah, it's so interdisciplinary. And it's not just, I mean, I think the key thing for me is not understanding. It's not just physical. It's about human. It can be about human beings as well and relationships. Mm-hmm. I like that phrase, spatial relations or relationships. And then, yeah, I was just thinking here, even the course, some of your course titles reflect that, like Race and Space in the U.S., Geographies of Peace and Violence. And maybe we can get into that in a little bit. Thank you for helping us understand your discipline there. So as an undergraduate, is that when you go to France?
Yes. So as I told you, I really want to travel, and
right.
And I think now that I'm a little bit older, I can reflect more critically about my choices. But I was really bound by a Eurocentric vision, you know, of the world, and I had this dream that I wanted to go to Europe. And so I studied French, you know, and Italian, and so I really wanted to go abroad and study in France. And so I my study abroad experience as an undergrad was the Allemont, which is west of Paris. And so I spent there like a full semester, and that was my first time outside Puerto Rico, and that experience transformed me fundamentally, shaping my worldview and leading me to geography.
Say a little bit more about that, how it transformed you.
So my background in Puerto Rico is like within Puerto Rican society, you know, I'm very much like I will be categorized as what we call blanquito, a whitey. So meaning that I was like a, you know, white middle class kid, you know, kind of privileged. In many ways, shielded from most inequalities in the world, you know. And so when I went to France, you know, I had not been exposed to forms of racism or discrimination. And upon getting there, I suffered from discrimination for looking like North African. You know, I was stopped by the police and whatnot. Wow. And so for me, that was very shocking, and I could not believe that such injustice existed. And so I was determined to understand the root causes of those forms of discrimination, why some people are treated differently from others.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying like it was a very naive sort of view of the world that led me not to becoming sort of aware of injustices, I guess.
Right, a naive view that led you to develop a critical view in all the good senses of that word, critical. So I'm thinking, you know, lots of things that I'm thinking. I mean, how Black Americans, you know, and before World War II and even after, were able to go to France, and at least some of them, if not all, you know, and feel welcome. But then your time there, is it that coinciding with the sort of immigration from North Africa? And is that what was going on?
Yeah, well, the immigration from North Africa had been going on during the post-World War II era in France. You know, as people might know, France is had many colonies across Africa and Asia, right, and the Caribbean as well. And so these former colonies of France, including after the bloody Algerian War in the 1950s yes. and 60s, led to sort of a huge migration of North Africans, including Algerians, Tunisians, and Moroccans in particular, but many other other former colonies from Africa, like Chad, Congo, and you know, many others. So you have a really large immigrant population in France. And many of them, and not all of them, but many of them are concentrated in housing projects, as what we will call housing projects here in the United States, that are located not in the so-called inner city, but they're actually located in the suburbs, right? So the urban structure of European cities is a little bit different from ours. And so these populations have primarily since 1970s been isolated in these housing projects, isolated from basic services like transportation, jobs, and other public services, and sort of have been suffering from high levels of unemployment, discrimination, and exclusions. And also, as you might imagine, has also been in close contact with what we call carceral institutions, the police, sure, the courts, and prisons. And so in 2005, in particular, there was a big set of riots in France that started in the suburbs of Paris, but expanded throughout France, called the 2005 riots, from October, November of that year. You know, many young people from immigrant extraction really fed up with the treatment by the state, by the police, by governmental officials and so forth, and by French institutions in general. And so my dissertation was to understand precisely what's happening there, why they fed up, why this horrific treatment of immigrant populations. And what I found out is that race really structures and coloniality, you know, the colonial relation really structures the way they're treated in general in society. And so I use a geographic lens to understand the way in which the criminal justice system further the exclusion and segregation of these populations in society.
That's all fascinating. I wanted to ask you about your dissertation, so this is perfect. The the other thing that I was also going to ask you, you know, what explains their treatment? And so it's the colonial status, I guess, still, and race. Do they have voting rights? I'm not familiar enough with their status. What is it? Are they denied certain rights that we would associate with full citizenship?
No. I mean, we're talking about folks that by now we're talking about many, not all, but are second, third generations. They were born in France. They were raised in France. They are French citizens. But nevertheless, do not feel that they're part of French society. No?
Right.
So they do have voting rights and all sorts of other citizenship rights, formal citizenship rights. But socially, they are not treated as such.
And it sounds like they're not treated as such by what we would call the criminal justice or carceral system. Talk mm-hmm. a little bit more about your dissertation research, which I found really interesting. You're looking at kind of like crime control in these neighborhoods. Tell us a little bit about your findings.
The period I was exploring this was really interesting because it was in the post 2005 riots, which was a really important moment in contemporary French history. So this question was very prevalent in the minds of policymakers and everyone. And so I was really interested in the ways in which sort of both the liberal discourse said like, okay, we need to sort of tone down our policing approach. But at the same time, they kept using heavy policing tactics and the prison system to control a population, which they thought that could only respond to policing and the prison to solve their multiple crises. No, and so we see the story being reproduced and replicated in many other contexts. So I was really paying attention not to the police itself, but I was looking at the courts. And so I was looking at a particular set of policies that have created local courts in these neighborhoods, and looking at how the courts were mobilizing, rather than being like centrally located, rather than having people go to the courts went to the people to sort of accelerate the prosecution and resolution of conflicts. And so what I found is that they created a whole system where the punitive logic for solving crimes in society became hegemonic. No?
Great phrase, punitive logic. Yeah. So I mean, there aren't mobile courts like this in similar neighborhoods or different neighborhoods. I mean, white neighborhoods. This is unique to these neighborhoods, I'm guessing. I'm assuming.
And they weren't necessarily prosecuting people to send to jail, but they were prosecuting sort of minor conflicts that, in wealthier neighborhoods, people will solve among themselves. But in this case, they had to mobilize state resources to solve conflicts.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's fascinating. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, I'm done.
No, I'm just thinking about the potential parallels between police situation here vis-a-vis Black Americans, especially in what you're describing. Mm-hmm. But that kind of intense policing. Yeah. And then how some neighborhoods would solve these things among themselves, but then other places are perceived to require police and even the courts. I find that really, really interesting.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
Just say one last thing about that. I think that the logic behind that is very much rooted in sort of these colonial understandings of society, where we repeatedly, I kept hearing both judges, police officers, and other social workers saying, like, these populations lack the ability to solve their own conflicts, therefore they need our intervention. So this very paternalistic view is rooted in particular assumptions about how particular societies and cultures, quote unquote, can do, or what their capacity is, or what the limits are. No?
Right. Can they, I'm thinking about in this country, I mean, you know, the idea that Black Americans or women do, you know, can't be self-governing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's rooted in race. It's rooted in colonialism, the two things going together, so-called race. I put that word in quotes, perceptions of race. Anyway, it's fascinating. So from there, did you turn some of that into articles, journal articles, or what did you?
And I published some of that work in various journals of geography, where I was really engaging with some of the another subfield of human geography called legal geographies, and also carceral geographies, who are looking at these sort of questions of prisons and other carceral institutions and their sort of spatial relationships. So I published a couple of articles on documenting sort of the particular ways in which the courts were operating in these neighborhoods and the logics behind them.
Your trajectory, that's great about the articles. Congrats on that. And I'm just thinking about your trajectory. So just picking up what you said earlier, you're kind of Eurocentric. I want to learn Spanish or French, sorry, and Italian. Yeah. Go there. But you wind up studying something.
Exactly.
You wind up at odds with that Eurocentrism, at least in your work. All interesting. So now, fast forward to now, you're working on, it sounds like you're working on a project with another academic, I guess. But tell us a little bit about your work on debt and Puerto Rico in particular.
Yeah. So I think there's a segue there between that research in France and my current research. I do believe this is happening in 2016. I think that's a crucial time. Okay. So I actually got one of these internal grants at Gustavus to go spend a summer and do research in France, which I did. And I went to France in 2016 to do some research. So I wanted to expand on these questions about the courts and mobile courts and whatnot. But then while that was happening, there was Puerto Rico announced that it was broke, that it could not pay. And so suddenly I was like, what's happening here? So I had this extra research money. I was like, okay, I can go to Puerto Rico and sort of learn a little bit more about this. Let me do some research. Which I recruited a couple of my friends who happened to also be some of them academics. And we conducted this research, which resulted in an article that I published in the journal Antipode, documenting the way the debt crisis manifested itself in the urban landscape of San Juan.
Tell us more about that, how it did manifest itself.
So what we did was we did this very extended walking tour that lasted 2 days. And we went from basically the University of Puerto Rico in Rio Piedras, which is in the center of San Juan. And we walk north all the way to Old San Juan. So in that journey walking, we took photos. We sort of observed the landscape and sort of trying to understand, for instance, what sort of projects, investments led to the current debt of the state, no? So we sort of saw like they had this sort of urban train that cost over $1 billion to construct.
Good Lord.
They had this Colosseum to host sports and entertainment events that also cost millions of dollars. So, you know, so we were able to see sort of some of the causes of the debt manifest in the landscape, but also that came at the expense of a huge number of abandoned buildings that you can see across the urban landscape. And in the midst of these abandoned buildings, you have pockets of hip neighborhoods that are emerging that you can see like there's some money trickling into the city, but it's not fairly distributed. No? So you have these huge inequalities being sort of manifested in the landscape of massive big elephants, no, in the landscape with spaces abandoned. And then you have sort of the emergence here. There are huge pockets, tiny pockets of hip neighborhoods from wealthier families and residents. And so we wanted to understand, okay, so what happens, you know, why the debt created this, and what are people doing to contest the debt, no?
Why? All fascinating to me. By the way, I'm a closet. I love cities. I love urban, just about any city. I'm an urban guy on my dad's side. Grew up Greek American in Chicago. Anyway, so this is of extreme interest to me, and it's relevant to other cities. I mean, there's some similarities, parallels. But where's the capital for these projects coming? Does it come from the U.S. primarily? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a variety of sources, but the main one is from the municipal bonds market. Okay. Okay. So Puerto Rico, as being part of the United States, has access to these municipal bonds. You know, when cities sort of, I mean, St. Peter, for instance, recently wanted to construct a school, a high school. So they got a bond, you know, that's from the municipal bond. And so it's a safer bet in a way. Right. Puerto Rico being a colony, and this is where the colonial history comes into play, since the 1917, I believe, they have this triple tax exception, meaning that Puerto Rico bonds are exempt from local, state, and federal taxes. So By the early 2000s, Puerto Rico bonds became very attractive for investors from Wall Street.
Sure.
Because they were exempt from taxes.
Tax-free, right.
So there were financial institutions like JP Morgan and Wells Fargo and you name it, all these financial institutions started pushing for the Puerto Rico government who was cash strapped. To get these massive bonds, loans from the municipal bonds. So they started like increasing their debt from, I believe, end of the 90s was like, $14 billion. And so all the way to 2016, where the debt accrued to $74 billion.
Good God. Oh my God.
And so this became a whole business and the local politicians, in order to win elections and stay afloat, even though they knew they were bankrupt, they kept issuing more bonds and more loans to the point that in 2016, the credit agencies rated Puerto Rico's bonds as junk, and therefore they started excluding them from the capital market. And that's when the Puerto Rico government said, oh, we don't have any source for generating money anymore. And so when they said publicly, we have no money to pay our debts, usually in a regular case in the United States, like Detroit or Washington, D.C., some cases that come to mind, they have the constitutional right to declare bankruptcy.
Right.
Puerto Rico has been in this sort of ambivalent colonial space, didn't have that right. They were exempt from all these taxes, right? And they could borrow money, but they could not declare bankruptcy. And so there was no recourse for the local government. So the government of Puerto Rico was left to their own device, like figure it out, you know? And so that's when the Obama administration came up with the infamous law, the Promesa Law.
Yes.
in 2016, which was highly, it was celebrated at the time. Like, oh, finally, they're doing something. But that law has really hampered Puerto Rico's future in many ways.
And I, how I so?
So, so the law is designed to primarily respond to Puerto Rico's debt, but it's also it's designed to respond to future debts that territories of the United States incur. So U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam, and other territories. No? So it, it could apply to them. And so the law said that they will institute a fiscal control board appointed by Congress. So it's not democratically elected. That will from now on will control and manage the finances of Puerto Rico. So they will control the budget. So previously the local legislature in Puerto Rico had full control of finances and they could submit a budget and prove it and you know and that was it. But now that budget that they approve has to go to the fiscal control board for further approval. We, the people, or the people that vote, the voters, don't have control of who is a member of that board. And so their future depends on these seven members who may or may not have any relationship with Puerto Rico.
Basically can control the fate of the country.
Yeah,
I so say country, for instance, colony.
Yeah, so so they've cut budget locations to the University of Puerto Rico, for instance, to other public services over the last 4 or 5 years. The government of Puerto Rico has closed over 300 public schools, affecting thousands of families and children. I mean, we are in a full scale. Austerity regime that is designed primarily to ensure that ultimately the government of Puerto Rico pays their debt to bondholders.
And we've seen some of these austerity regimes in other places in history and certainly in post-war history. It's a nightmare for the people. Absolute nightmare. What kind? You mentioned earlier you're interested also in how people are pushing back against this. What? Tell us a little bit about that. What kind of activism or organization or political movements are there in response to this?
Oh, there's many, and I could spend like we could do another show on that, but it's amazing. So in 2016 that happened and people started mobilizing, but particularly after Hurricane Maria hit, that really created the opportunities for both the fiscal control board and the local government to push further other more austerity measures that otherwise it would have been a little bit more difficult to implement. No, people were in crisis, so they started like privatizing many services, and so Hurricane Maria created also the conditions for local organizations to form, community organizations, mutual aid organizations that that in light of the fact that the state had abandoned them, they decided to distribute resources among themselves and to solve their own conflicts. And so everything led to the debt. And so many of these organizations have created like an intersectional approach to dealing with the debt. So you have feminist organizations, you have environmental organizations, you have community organizations that have emerged that are trying to rethink what a post-debt Puerto Rico could look like. And you've had also organizations that have formed that have more a legal approach to it, but that have tried to push for an audit, a full audit of the debt, because we don't have an audit. We don't know what that money is, who spent it. The government decided not to pursue an audit, so that's up in the air. And so there's many fronts. People are fighting on many fronts on how not to to imagine a Puerto Rico that is not controlled by bondholders or their views of the future.
This is so important. I mean, I'm thinking of Haiti, and a lot of people don't realize, I mean, Haiti, you think, oh, Haiti, the poorest nation in the hemisphere. Well, why? Because of the debt that it incurred, right? Going back to the, right after the revolution. I mean, the incredible debt. So I find your work not only quite interesting, but incredibly important. Do you think, what are the prospects for Puerto Rico, in the, at least in the, you know, in the next, let's say, 5-10 years? What's your sense of that in terms of this crisis?
Well, I try not to fall into the trap of being too pessimistic. Very easy. We can fall on that very easily. But one of the biggest so my work. So let me go back a little bit here to give a little bit more context. So I started interested in the debt now, but then I wanted to know where this debt, the conditions that led to the debt, where they come from. That's the biggest question I wanted to get.
That's the historian in you.
Yeah, and so I decided, okay, I wanna go back in history. I wanna know what happened here. So I landed on the 1940s. When Puerto Rico began to modernize its institutions, economy, and general landscape, and became sort of like transitioning from an agrarian to an industrial economy, and I found that period fascinating because that's like a lot of the institutions that led eventually to the problem of debt were created in that time period. And so I like to see it, you know, like the larger picture, because like if we see the short picture, the short time, like we don't see any exit. No,
no, that's right. We got to look at the historical context, the historical origins. Yep.
Exactly. So that's allowed me to see that this was a choice that we made. This was a set of decisions that were made that led us here.
Is that the planning board you're talking about?
I'm looking at the planning board at the time and looking at how the planning board shaped the landscape of Puerto Rico to facilitate the entrance of U.S. capital, the industrial capital to Puerto Rico.
And were those members of the board, were they elected or appointed? You know, how?
Yeah, so this was a government instrumentality. So they were appointed by the government at the time. So the first chair of the board was a geographer. so that's why there's the connection. And that's partly why I'm studying that. No? I'm trying to understand how geographers had to do with the development of modern Puerto Rico.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But one of the first things, and this is where I'm tying things to the present, one of the first things that the government of Puerto Rico did in particular in 1947, they had many industries owned by the state at the time that were manufacturing shoes and bottles for rum and whatnot. They sold all those industries to the private sector, to private hands. And they decided to rely on tax incentives as the strategy for development. Hmm. In 1947, they signed the tax exception law, which provided many exceptions for U.S. investors to come and invest in Puerto Rico. So if you created a manufacturing site here, you had all these sort of capital incentives and tax exemptions that made Puerto Rico very attractive for that. And so I trace that as a key moment in the history of Puerto Rico because suddenly we became fully dependent on foreign capital.
Foreign capital, yeah.
For our development. So when suddenly, so Puerto Rico had no money, so they suddenly went to the municipal bond market to get capital. When they were denied that, suddenly what they have now is because we don't have access to capital markets yet. Now what they created is a very expansive tax incentive program, and they've invited pretty much U.S. millionaires and billionaires to move to Puerto Rico tax-free and to invest in Puerto Rico. Mm. So what's happened in 2012 is that you have these flocks of multimillionaires going to Puerto Rico. I mean, I'm talking about the worst of the worst. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Are buying property, are fueling the displacement of the local populations, not only in San Juan, but in the mountain region, goes along the coastline, buying beachfront property. And people are very scared. And because they want a Puerto Rico without Puerto Ricans.
Well said. Oh my gosh.
That's not mine. That's a slogan that people have said, Puerto Rico, we without Puerto Ricans.
God, that's brilliant. Yeah, we're going to come by. We're going to buy a Puerto Rico without Puerto Rico. Jeez.
And so what you have is really interesting set of politics right now in Puerto Rico, where if before the colonial question was not discussed as much because Puerto Rico was relatively prosperous, within the crisis and sort of now visually seeing so many U.S. millionaires moving to Puerto Rico and doing really and the horrific politics, no, not saying all Americans, but these ones in particular, people are really talking actively about an active process of settler colonialism and other forms of colonialism. And so you have this really interesting set of conversations happening in Puerto Rico that are of people thinking about the relationship with the land, thinking about the relationship with the U.S., thinking about the relationships about with the economy, and really rethinking what we want as a future. For whom, no?
For whom, right. What and for whom.
Yeah.
That's all fascinating. So it's really... I'm going to use the phrase interdisciplinary. You've got people, there's sort of an environmental aspect to it, relationship to the land, political, economic, social. Mm-hmm. The key here, I guess the through thread is the colonial dependency, right? Whether it's bringing, you know, inviting manufacturing businesses who are now, you know, wealthy individuals, that's the through thread. And so, yeah, how do you decolonize and eliminate that awful dependency and the debt burden that goes with it?
Precisely.
That's a tall order, but I'm like you. I have to be hopeful. I want to be hopeful. It beats the opposite. It beats pessimism, I think, for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. I think one point I wanted to make is like it's a function of debt, no? And sort of and I think that functions not as a mechanism of economic development, of course, because it's not. But it functions as a mechanism to reproduce the colony, to further those colonial relations. I think people are aware that the debt is a trap. It's a total trap that is furthering the dependency of Puerto Rico to the U.S., right, to U.S. markets. And so right now, Puerto Rico has one of the highest, if not the highest, sales tax in all of the United States. Wow. I think it's 11.5%. All that sales tax is going directly to paying debt.
To paying off the debt, yeah.
So it's not going to...
Not going to schools
and stuff for it. So living in Puerto Rico means that every time you go buy something, you are paying the debt. So that money goes straight to Wall Street. No?
Yeah, so that's an extraction. It's not, you're not extracting minerals, but it's still an extraction, a colonial. Wow. Absolutely fascinating. So it's not, will this be a book or journal articles or both? You're not sure at this point?
The plan is to, this is a book project. And so you mentioned the NEH grant that I got, that I'm very grateful that allowed me to do archival research.
Yeah, congrats on that.
Thank you. That allowed me to do archival research in Puerto Rico. I was also in sabbatical right before the pandemic started. So I was able to seize that moment. It's documenting the origins of the planning board and its evolution, precisely to document the ways in which sort of the construction of modern Puerto Rico has led to created the conditions, no? For the extraction of capital that is happening now.
Right. And this reminds me of something I was saying earlier. I like that your conceptual framework here isn't sort of, it's just a top down, but I mean that you said earlier people made choices. This planning board people for sure. I think that's important. That gives agency to people, you know, certain people in Puerto Rico able to make those decisions. It's not just you know, top down.
Yeah,
fascinating work. Go ahead.
I think it's just wanted to point out that it's really important to denaturalize some of these processes that I've seen people say, well, that's how things are, you know.
Right.
I want to really my work to denaturalize those, to demystify that we're not these are not these were decisions made by others, you know?
Right. That's the power, that's one power of history. You go back and you realize, oh, things didn't have to be exactly the way they are. And if they didn't have to be the way they are, then they don't have to continue to be the way they are, right?
That's what I'm doing, historical research.
You are preaching to the choir here for sure. we're out of time. I know you have to go, but if you have time, what's your pitch for the liberal arts and teaching at a place like Gustavus?
Thanks. Again, as I said, I think I mentioned at the beginning, like I'm going to center it to geography, and I think that geography is a truly liberal arts field, precisely because it's interdisciplinary. We special relations happen at all times everywhere, and so we need to draw. And right now, I'm drawing on historians. I'm in conversation with my historians and political scientists and sociologists. I mean, and even literature. I mean, even a conversation with literary critics as well. So in that sense, I do think that geography departments and geography programs should exist in every liberal arts colleges, no? Because it blends so nicely with the approach and objectives of that type of education, which seeks to broaden one's fields of knowledges in order to, as Gustavus says, tackle the biggest challenges of our times.
Right.
And I do truly believe that understanding sort of the spatial relationships that shape, for instance, colonial relations currently and in the past, or the environmental crisis and so forth, is a crucial element that I think liberal colleges are uniquely positioned to tackle from multiple angles, no? And something we've learned is that not one discipline has the answers to everything.
Right.
Not one expert can solve everything. We need that liberal arts education where we can sort of appreciate the knowledges from different fields and disciplines.
Couldn't agree more. Well said. Thank you so much for this. It was a pleasure. We have to do more because there are more questions I want to ask you. But good luck with the current project. It's really important. And the other thing we didn't get into, I mean, all of your work around diversity, equity, inclusion at Gustavus is really important. And you've been at that for a long time. So that's another podcast. But Joaquin has been.
I just want to say that open invitation. I'm happy to be back because we've been talking about this for a long time, I'm happy to come back anytime.
Thank you. Take good care. Good luck with all the stuff you're juggling, the strike, the teacher strike, on and on and on. And we'll see one another in person, I hope, soon again. So take good care. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate
see
ya.
It. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing, Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.